Shout out and thank you to Smile Brilliant for sponsoring this episode. You are listening to We Sell the Devil, an investigative and conversational true crime podcast that deep dives into fascinating criminal cases that are solved, unsolved, or ongoing. From America's Lori Vallow to Germany's Armin Mivas, we examine and discuss the world's most shocking cases. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to follow us online. Check us out at WeSawTheDevil.com and WeSawTheDevil on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And don't forget, you can become part of the show by backing us on Patreon. Hello, everyone. You are listening to We Saw the Devil. This is Robin, and today's episode is a true crime news headline episode where I once again pick some news headlines out of the news related to true crime and discuss them. This episode also does, yes, contain the Lori Vallow case update, so we will be getting there momentarily. Before we get into the episode, though, let's just get some quick housekeeping out of the way. As always, you can find us at WeSawTheDevil.com. From there, you can find our socials, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, where you can find us at WeSawTheDevil across the board, basically. You can also find a link to our Patreon, which if you're loving the show, liking the show, want to financially back it and get some benefits, you can do so for as little as $3 a month. And also in terms of that, want to talk about YouTube for a moment. We actually have a considerable base on YouTube, and a lot of you, which first of all, thank you. I know listening to a podcast episode like in the browser of your computer or maybe even from your phone, it's a little different, you know, because we did start out as a podcast, you know, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, so on and so forth. Something that I've always wanted to do, but I just haven't had the bandwidth to do it. I've only done it once, actually. Is do accompanying YouTube videos for each episode. So when I discuss legal documents or pictures or people from cases and crime scenes and things like that, you know, to have the visuals to go along with it, I think that goes a long way. So I'm currently trying to figure out how to balance having an audio podcast and then also a YouTube channel where people watch YouTube for the visuals. So trying to figure out how to balance the two of them between episodes, and I would like to start putting out video content. So I'm not sure as of right now what that's going to look like. Making a video is actually fairly time consuming. You know, a lot of the times, especially if it's a Lori Vallow update, it may happen in the afternoon, and I do my very best to try to get episodes out concisely following certain news items. So I don't know, guys, trying to mull it over in my mind, but I would like to start doing videos for our YouTube channel. And YouTube also has the membership system, you know, there for extra content and things like that. But I'd like to at least start getting some video content to go along with our episodes. So be on the lookout for that. Still trying to figure out how to do that in an efficient manner, because I also don't want to slight our audio, like our podcast listeners. And as always, if you are liking the show, if this is the first time you've listened to the show and you want to hear more, titty slap that subscribe button. You can do so on whatever, wherever you are listening to this podcast on currently, and you'll be notified of new episodes. And furthermore, if you want to support the show, but you don't or can't quite commit to doing so on Patreon, leave that 5-star review for us. Again, it's the best thing overall that you can do to help a podcast with marketing and sponsorships and things like that. So we would greatly appreciate it. Final thing here, guys, kind of overhauling the show. And what I mean by that is we're kind of overhauling the aesthetics of the show. So I have been working with a graphic designer, and the look of the show is going to change entirely. Some of the feedback that we've gotten is that it's too dark, which I totally get. You know, honestly, I would feel the same way. So we actually have a brand new logo, new design, new color scheme, the whole bit. Don't be shocked if all of a sudden in wherever, like say on your iTunes, the cover art changes. Just know that it's coming and we are still the same podcast. So I guess that about sums it up for the housekeeping. So let's get into it. One of the very first items that I read about this week is Chris Watts. Chris Watts just had his 36th birthday, which is crazy. I'm 36. And looking at the case, I'm just like, wow, this man who's my age murdered his pregnant wife and two young daughters, for those of you who are unaware. His case just went viral. It was just really, really, really a popular topic in the true crime community because of how heinous it was. More or less, it's your typical story of man cheating on wife, except she was pregnant. So man cheating on wife, having affairs, didn't want the family anymore. So he murdered all of them. Incredibly sad. Chris is currently being housed at the Dodge Correctional Institution, which is a maximum security prison in Waupun, Wisconsin. And apparently there is a source in prison who frequently talks to People magazine, specifically about Chris. And this anonymous source basically described Chris Watts's day-to-day. He says that he's constantly alone in prison because, quote, no one wants anything to do with him. He's the lowest social tier of the entire prison. He's in protective custody because if he's around other inmates, he'd be in real danger. He's an outcast even among criminals. Which, no complaints here, none whatsoever. But Chris apparently spends all of his time writing his many, many, many pen pals who, you guessed it, are almost all women. I will, for the life of me, never understand. I've never understood this whatsoever. And, you know, there's obviously a lot of links and kind of like likeness to the Scott Peterson case, right? Even though it's currently up for debate and we may be going into an appeal and a new trial and all of this other stuff, he was convicted of murdering his pregnant wife, Lacey. After Scott was convicted and on his way to prison, the day that he arrived to serve his sentence, his death sentence, the prison had already received 3 calls from women asking if they could marry him. And that was literally like the day that he was convicted and sentenced to death. So I just, for the life of me, I will never, ever, ever understand women who are attracted to killers. Probably should do an episode on that too, because just, ugh. Also, I just want to follow up and thank Adrian, who reached out to us in one of my graphic sexual horror episodes, which don't worry, I have not forgotten about it. I mentioned how I just really want to get to the bottom of worldwide statistics as far as spouses killing one another or a partner killing their spouse. And Adrian, she reached out to us on Facebook and provided a couple links, which thank you very much. So I just want to cite those. So worldwide, the World Health Organization says that a partner or spouse is the killer in 38% of women's homicides. Previous research in the U.S. suggested that intimate partners carried out more than 40% of homicides of women and about 7% of homicides of men. So 40% of homicides of women are conducted, carried out by an intimate partner, which is just terrifying. However, that has gone down. I believe that the all-time high was like 43%. So apparently it's heading in the right direction, but it's still terrifying. Another piece in my last episode of the news headlines that I did that apparently you guys wanted to hear more about is Josh Duggar. You will not believe this, or maybe you will. I mean, I guess it's par for the course. So last week I discussed the history of Josh Duggar's scandals, how he molested 5 of his own sisters, admitted to doing it. That was a huge scandal. The Ashley Madison hack, where it was revealed that he was seeking out women and having many affairs on his wife. Then he had the porn star who came out and said that they met for consensual sex, but that he ended up violently raping her. Now we have the child pornography charges. Since last week, it's been reported that Anna Duggar is standing by Josh. Anna apparently told one of her friends, who of course leaked it to the news, that she believes that Josh is a good man and may have been set up, get this, by President Joe Biden. Anna Duggar honestly believes that none of this would be happening if Donald Trump were still in power. And that makes total sense. I mean, I can totally see it because Joe Biden is, you know, currently overseeing a crisis, an escalation in the Middle East, like on the brink of absolute total warfare. You know, he's just been dealing with a national and global pandemic, job losses, record homelessness. And yep, I mean, you know what? He woke up one day or he became president and he's like, you know what? I'm going to take Josh Duggar down and I'm going to have people plant child porn on his computer and then sick Department of Homeland Security on him. Makes total sense. Congratulations, Anna Duggar. Nancy Drew has nothing on you and you solved this fucking case. Hooray. That was my first reaction, right? Like, that's actually the first reaction. Like, are we kidding? But it's beyond that. If you actually kind of read between the lines and understand the context of all of that, I find it terribly sad. And also in the last episode, I discussed a few of the religious beliefs that the Duggar family subscribes to. I knew this particular nugget of information, but I wasn't sure. So over the last week, I've done a little bit more research because the Duggars themselves self-identify as independent Baptists. Now, first and foremost, I would like to put up a disclaimer. I am not shitting on Christianity or religion as a whole. These are just facts. So before anyone gets all upset or thinks I'm singling out and being disrespectful towards religion, these are just facts. So I didn't want to decisively frame it, but again, after more research, it looks like I can do that. So the Duggars themselves line up perfectly with the Quiverful brand of religion, even though they do self-identify publicly when asked as independent Baptists. What is the Quiverful movement? The Quiverful movement takes its name from this verse in Psalm 127. Quote, "Lo, children are a heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate." So, more or less, followers of the Quiverful movement want to have as many children as possible in order to build a pint-sized, fundamentalist Christian army to send out into the world. More or less, to basically force the world back into the Stone Age, you know, how they see fit, traditional gender roles, women don't leave the house. In fact, they plan to do this by literally out-reproducing every other religion out there. That is actually in their mission statement. Quiverful, and the children are arrows, okay? Like, they consider children arrows in their fight against heathens. Which is really kind of sick. Now, you know, if they're looking to rebrand, I have a few alternatives for them to maybe consider. What about the Skeet for Jesus Club? Child Soldier Subscription Box? Young and Hung? Or Come Unto Jesus? I mean, I have no idea. You know, they think that having many, many, many children is the best gift that you can give God. And I want to know that if children are such a gift, why is it wrong to try buying one for a friend's birthday? But kidding aside, the idea behind the Quiverful movement is to make as many kids as possible over the next few generations in order to take over not just other religions, but governments, cities, and so that they can boycott wicked businesses. And I didn't know that some people protest by eating Chick-fil-A and then having copious amounts of unprotected sex, but that's pretty much what they do. Hear me out here. They are literally, at the core, right? They will roll their family van, or bus, as in the Duggars' case, the family bus, to Chick-fil-A on Saturday, not Sunday. That's the Lord's Day, and chicken is not allowed, okay? But they'll go to Chick-fil-A as a protest, as a form of protest against more progressive values, inclusion. And then they go home, and then they have that sweet, hot, vanilla, missionary, hetero sex with their spouse in order to try to pop out as many crotch goblins as they can to take over the rest of the world. I mean, the Quiverful movement needs to be a sci-fi film. Please, someone do it. And yeah, they're crazy, right? But here's the thing. They aren't their own full brand of religion. Quiverful movement, that's what it is. It's a movement. It's an ideology. Quiverful families are found all over the country. They typically attend far-right evangelical churches, but not everyone in those churches is part of the Quiverful movement. I'm in the South. I'm born and raised here in Nashville. And obviously, Southern Baptist is a very, very far-right sect of Christianity, right? But here's the thing. Not all of them are Quiverful families. A lot of them think they're even batshit. These people are all over the country, and they're learning and connecting to one another via homeschooling. So Anna married Josh, and in the Quiverful movement, the wife is under the full authority of her husband. So likewise, a daughter is completely subservient to her father until the day that he, again he, finds her a suitable husband to take over his male role. I mean, it's literally trading their daughters like cattle. These women are never allowed to disobey the male authority figure, be it husband or father, even if it's something that they personally find immoral or illegal. And you can find this on the Quiverful's website because they, let's just say your husband wants you to kill someone. They believe that God would rather have you actually kill a man because your husband says so than to disobey the orders of a man. That is honest to God what they believe, and they literally, I pulled that example directly off their website. In essence, Anna is just following her religious brainwashing and upbringing. Regardless of what your husband or father does, no matter how illegal it is, you obey without question. And it's set up and structured this way for a reason. Men are the breadwinners and women aren't allowed to go to work, go to college. And in some quiverful communities, depending on where they are, even go to high school. What would a typical Anna do with 7, 8, 9 children? The entire game is rigged from the very start. Men control every aspect of the nuclear family, where they go, what they eat. The wife doesn't have a checking account. She has to beg or get money for clothing. He controls every aspect of the family. And not only that, but this particular ideology demonizes the outside world. And that includes police, fire, therapists, teachers, college professors. Women are taught to fear them and remain silent and then don't seek help. And then in case we needed any kind of reminder, national statistics say that 1 in 5 women will be raped at some point in her life, and 91% of the victims of rape and sexual assault are female. These female victims in these far-right conservative Christian movements, where will they go? They're terrified of everyone. And not only that, but they are brainwashed to the point where if they are raped, if they are taken advantage of, that it's their fault. Hey guys, it's Robin, and I'm here with a little pro tip. As I told you in our last episode, I grind my teeth horribly. I would honestly be surprised if I have any enamel left at all at this point. And that's why I'm excited to tell you about Smile Brilliant. First, I decided to try their night guards. They sent me an impression package and it took less than 15 minutes. I returned it in the prepaid envelope, and in a little over a week, the lab created my night guards and they were delivered right to my front door. And they are comfortable, they fit snugly, and I'm even sleeping more soundly, which if you know me personally, you know that that is a feat unto itself. And the best part is that unlike the more expensive night guards in the market, they are a fraction of the cost and last for up to 3 months before they get worn out. I'm so pleased with them that I decided to try one other product, and they have an electric toothbrush, a water flosser, and a couple other things, but I decided to try Smile Brilliant's teeth whitening system. I've tried a bunch of different brands and it just never really seemed to work, or it was too much for my teeth. And I have super sensitive teeth, so I chose light stains for sensitive teeth. And I received the entire system at my door within a week. I'm currently halfway through my 27 applications, and I've already noticed a huge difference that I honestly never saw with big box store whitening gels. They just did not work. Like me, are you tired of grinding all night long? Do sleepless nights leave your jaw feeling sore each morning? Well, stop taking your tooth enamel to Pound Town and start protecting those pearly whites. And I'm super excited to offer a discount code so you can try Smile Brilliant too. Head on over to www.smilebrilliant.com and use DEVIL at checkout to get 30% off. Once again, that's www.smilebrilliant.com and use DEVIL at checkout. On the Quiverful movement, on its own website, they have different articles where basically it's almost like a Dear Abby where women write in and seek counsel or to get advice. And this one woman wrote and she said, you know, my husband and I got married when we were young. We immediately started having children. My first child was super sick. I didn't offer sex to my husband. I was dealing with a household, and then I got pregnant again, and that baby was very sick, and you know, it took everything out of me. And my husband became resentful because I wasn't having sex with him at night when he wanted to. And then he was cold and would snap at me. And I just felt like I was basically having a mental breakdown. Then she got a phone bill in the mail. And the phone bill was for a sex hotline. Like, you know, the $1.99 a minute, like spank tank phone lines. And her husband was calling a phone sex line, spending thousands of dollars on phone sex. And she said that, you know, she went to her pastor who said, divorce, you need to get an attorney. You have grounds here. All of her friends said the same thing. Her church said the same thing. And then she spoke with another person who also happened to be in the Quiverful movement. And they told her that it's her fault. That regardless of anything going on in her life, that it's her fault. And so this woman, with joy, wrote how she went to her husband with a phone bill in hand and said, "We need to talk." She said that he was terrified and looked really upset and started to get angry. And she said to him, "I'm sorry that I was not a better wife to you, and I'm sorry that I did not submit, that I may have frustrated you and I may have talked back to you, and I'm sorry that I haven't given you sex." Apparently, that made their relationship so much stronger that she just had to determine, she had to decide to submit. And it cured all of their relationship's ailments. And this is what these women are taught from a very, very young age. But what about Josh? In a religion where men are absolved of sexually violent behavior because women are temptresses, women have to dress modestly, speak quietly, and everything is sexualized. Boys and girls, even at a very, very young age, aren't allowed in rooms together. Male and female siblings can't even hug one another as children because they don't want their front genitals even touching or even being in the same direction. So in situations like that, how did Josh know what he did was wrong if there wasn't a line explicitly stated? Because like most conservative religions, the Quiverful movement is obsessed with sex. I mean, they think about sex more than anyone. They think about gay people more than gay people. They are obsessed with sex and sexuality. So according to them, unless you're a heterosexual married couple having that, you know, banging vanilla vaginal missionary sex, you're sinning. Full stop. Sex outside of that particular scenario is the absolute worst kind of sin imaginable. I mean, literally equal to murder and genocide. And this is basically ingrained into its followers from a very young age. So we can kind of stop with the poor Josh sentiment that I've actually seen in a lot of different places. But because of the system that's been put in place, he got away with it. Because as Jim Bob himself, his father, said in an interview, quote, "Josh was just curious and completely brushed it off with no care for the girls whatsoever." And another interesting piece is that Josh did receive a stern lecture. His parents apparently called a family friend who happened to be a state trooper, and just so you know, also a member of the Quiverful community. The trooper apparently gave him a stern lecture. Also, guess what? That same state trooper was also later arrested on child pornography charges. And because of the Quiverful system and the environment and ideology, neither Josh nor his victims, particularly his own sisters, received any therapy at all. At all. None. From licensed professionals. It's so incredibly just disgusting. And I will finish the Josh segment here by just mentioning the most famous Quiverful parents that you have definitely heard of. That would be Rusty and Andrea Yates. And if you recalled, Rusty encouraged Andrea to continue having more children. She ended up having 5, and he kept pushing and pushing and pushing for her to have more. Now, that's regardless of the fact that a doctor, an OBGYN, had strongly advised against it. Andrea had experienced mental breakdowns, suicidal ideation, suicide attempts, and hospitalizations caused by the severity of her postpartum psychosis during each and every one of her previous 5 births. And he told Rusty, "Don't leave her alone. She's not well. She's mentally not well. You need to get her help." But again, that same system, mental health care is kooky and evil and of the devil. You just need to pray. All will be well. And it's a woman's job a normal, quiverful woman should do that as her duty. And Rusty ended up leaving her unsupervised, and Andrea Yates drowned all five of her own children. Moving right along to another case is an incredibly, incredibly sad case out of Oregon. I didn't personally know this man, but many, many, many people on my friends list on Facebook do from back home in Portland. They knew him very well. On May 1st, 37-year-old Michael Watts was visiting Portland from Eugene, Oregon. He was walking back to his hotel room around 10 p.m. He was very familiar with Portland, and Michael was FaceTiming his girlfriend. Now, the interesting part here is that the news that has come out has been very conflicting. Apparently, she told his parents, that he was out of breath. He mumbled something. He said, "Someone is chasing me." And then eventually they're right behind me before the call abruptly ended. A stranger ended up finding Michael's phone in the middle of the street, and Michael was never seen again. That's the last anyone ever heard from him. Tragically, this past Tuesday, the Portland police reported that they recovered Michael's body from the Willamette River near the Fremont Bridge. There's currently no additional information in terms of cause of death or any potential suspects at the moment. And Michael was considered an icon by many people in the LGBTQ community because he did a Freddie Mercury stage show calling himself Freddie Hollywood. And it's just crazy right now when I log onto Facebook, it's like memorial after memorial after article and people expressing sorrow over his death. And it's, first of all, heinously sad because by all accounts, he was an amazing person and friend to people that I know. But it's also very, very shady. He was not close to the river or the water. He was also very, very comfortable and came to Portland frequently. He was apparently out with friends and was just absolutely trashed beyond belief. So on Reddit, you're seeing a lot of kind of like debates on what could have happened to him. Did he get drunk? Did he wander way far away over down to the river? How did he get there? Was he murdered? And then you have the inconsistencies between the news reporting of him FaceTiming his girlfriend saying he was being followed, so on and so forth. And it's creepily similar to, the quote unquote smiley face killers, which I think that's a crock of shit, personally. I don't think there's like some nationwide roving band of people who kill people this way. But when I was living in Portland, Maine, I noticed that a lot of young men would go missing at the waterfront, like the main harbor in downtown Portland. Now, I had an engineering job and our office was on the waterfront. And I worked on the fifth floor, and I would literally look out my window as I sat at my computer and look at the harbor. As I worked there, I was keeping up with news more often because it happened right there. Slowly, all of these men started disappearing, and then they would eventually pull them dead out of the harbor. And these just aren't normal people. They were fishermen, athletes, one was a Coast Guard, a bunch of different people who, if you live in coastal Maine, you grow up in the water. You grow up either on the ocean, in a boat, you grow up, with water. All of these young men were going missing after being out in downtown Portland. Sometimes they had been drinking, sometimes not. Sometimes they were stone cold sober. And then a month later, they would actually be pulled up out of the harbor, sometimes 100 feet from where they supposedly were last seen. It was just absolutely bizarre. And I kept a very close tabs on this. And the last kid, and this is probably 2017, he was 25 years old. He went missing. His body was recovered. And in a Portland Press Herald article, it was quoting police. And they said in there that they have not basically ruled out, not a serial killer, but they worded it to mean that they're looking at the possibility that one person could be responsible for all of the deaths over the previous years. That was up. I shared that with everyone that I knew, highlighted it and sent it around, and then it was gone. They edited the article within probably 15 minutes after they posted it and took that section out. I don't know. I'm not saying there's a serial killer in Portland, but what I am saying is that is eerily similar, and I will be keeping an eye on seeing whether any other young men end up being transported halfway across the city to the harbor. But I really do want to do an episode on the missing men in Maine because it was just so creepy and probably my personal biggest question in life is there a serial killer operating in Portland, Maine? The missing men in the harbor thing goes back years. Now is the time I guess all of you have been waiting for. Let's talk about Lori Vallow. So Nate Eaton was called to testify as a lay witness at the hearing on change of venue on June 9th. And three other people were called to testify as well. Let's start with Nate. Now, my assumption with this is that they're going to claim that East Idaho News tainted a potential jury pool and that this would make the trials unfair. I mean, I think it's a long shot with absolutely no merit. I think most of us agree on this. And yes, Nate and team has, you know, they've covered every single aspect of the case. And also, yes, he got into a helicopter the day the children's bodies were discovered, buried on Chad Daybell's property. But, you know, that is what the news does. That's what journalists do. And that is what Nate Eaton is. No offense to you, Idahoans. I love it. But you guys have no shield statute for reporter's privilege. And I know that this has lightly been discussed, particularly in an ABC News article. But let's talk about what that means. So a shield statute is a law that provides journalists either an absolute or qualified privilege to refuse to disclose sources used or information obtained in the course of news gathering. More or less, reporters are not legally obligated to disclose their sources. Currently, 39 states plus the District of Columbia have some form of shield statute on their books. Unfortunately, I mean, I guess, you know, depending on which side you are currently on with this, there's no federal shield law in the country. So that this issue has entirely been left to the individual states. But how will this work in Idaho? Does that mean that Nate Eaton will have to divulge his sources? Not necessarily. And even though Idaho does not have a shield law, and even though no one has really made an effort via legislation to get one passed, there is actual legal precedent. However, the Idaho Constitution has been relied upon in the most significant Idaho decision recognizing a limited reporter's privilege, and that was the Wright case. Three of the four justices in that case, in the majority, agreed that Article 1 of Idaho's Constitution provides a basis for the reporter's privilege. Article 1 is the free speech / free press provision. Unfortunately, Idaho has a pretty fickle history with the shield issue. So I think that, I mean, because this case has so many eyes on it, I definitely think that Nate Eaton will be just fine. And honestly, I think that John Pryor may even withdraw it. What will Nate Eaton do? Like, what is the process of getting out of the subpoena? Well, first, it's recommended that the person who's subpoenaed hire an attorney and then have that attorney reach out to the issuer of said subpoena. And if you've watched the news, you've seen Nate Eaton's attorney's statement. Jeffrey Hunt is his attorney, and he said, quote, "News reporters should not be conscripted as witnesses for either side in a criminal case, particularly in a case of such enormous public interest and concern. The First Amendment protects the independence of the press so it can report on criminal cases and not be forced to become witnesses in them. We hope the defense will reconsider this course and withdraw the subpoena. If not, we will ask the court to quash the subpoena." So check mark off in the "I'm going to, you know, write you and suggest you kindly withdraw this." So check mark in that column. If John Pryor, however, does not withdraw, then Nate and his attorney will file a motion to quash it. And the motion to quash is literally the only certain means of seeking protection against a subpoena, period. This motion will be filed in the same court where that subpoena was issued. Now, there's a lot more information out there on the history of shield law in Idaho, and I could do a whole singular episode on how that would roll out in all the different ways and precedents, but I'm not. This is the base news that you need to know. What's most likely going to happen, in all honesty, if we're being real honest here, is that the grand jury is going to bring down murder indictments after the meeting in Fremont County. That started on Monday, the 17th, and it's actually going to go until the 20th. The charges, most likely, if this is going in the way that we are assuming that they are going, the charges will then all be combined and in a way will be starting over, like in a sense, right? The change of venue hearing is going to be like, we'll figure that shit out down the road. It's going to be vastly delayed and punted. So again, this is a very, very, very important week for this case. So the three other people called as lay witnesses would be Heather Daybell, Chad Daybell's sister-in-law. There's private investigator Joe Adriani, And then a woman named Andrea Frick. And guys, I'm going to put it out there. I have been trying. Originally, I thought that Andrea Frick was someone who did some polling in Rexburg. Is that correct? I have been researching and researching and going down rabbit holes, and I cannot figure out how Andrea Frick plays into this. What I do know is that if you go to John Pryor, like, law office, like the review page of him, a woman by the name of Andrea Frick left him a comment on his business page, like a five-star review. And then a person by the name of Russell Frick also left a five-star review. And this pertained to a divorce case. Then I discovered a podcast on YouTube that was discussing this case in general, and there was an Andrea Frick there talking about basically how everyone needs to leave John Pryor alone. He's a wonderful man. First of all, Andrea Frick, you're probably not, but if you are listening, good men don't try to trade legal counsel for sex. But yeah, who is she? Is she a pollster in Rexburg? Can anyone please confirm that for me? It's very rare that I don't get to the bottom of a rabbit hole, but yeah, I failed in this one. So that's pretty much it for the Lori Vallow case, guys. We're going to be on countdown. I will bring as much information as soon as possible when the indictment information starts coming out, releasing, or ends on the 20th. If we find something out. So if you're interested in the Lori Vallow case at all, titty slap the subscribe button so you can stay up to date, because another episode will be coming later this week on what transpires. And finally, the last story of this episode, guys, is it's actually breaking news. Barry Morphew, shitbag and alleged murderer of his beautiful wife, Suzanne Morphew, has just received some additional charges. So if you recall, again, to recap, Suzanne Morphew, beautiful, 49 years old, mother of two daughters. She went missing on Mother's Day in 2020, and her husband was just arrested a couple weeks ago on May 5th and charged with her murder, tampering with evidence, as well as attempting to influence public servants. Okay, so a week later, he was then charged with forgery and ballot fraud. Apparently, in the 2020 election, he filled out a ballot and voted for Donald Trump using Suzanne's name. Now, yeah, his wife Suzanne, who was by then deceased. So now, breaking news, as of today, there are additional charges, and these include tampering with a deceased human body and possession of a dangerous weapon. So the new charge actually indicates in the offense date section that it was on May 9th, 2020, the day before Mother's Day, the day that she was reported missing. So a criminal complaint alleges that Barry Morphew killed Suzanne between May 9th or May 10th. And again, there's no information on how she was killed, anything like that, because there's no body. We do not yet know what the evidence is that supports their belief that Barry killed Suzanne. I mean, if behavior alone, which we know it can't, but if behavior alone makes you look guilty, then So the possession of a dangerous weapon charge, though, is related to a short rifle that he owned at that time. But yeah, there's no new information there. It's just so sad. So incredibly sad. So that is it for today, guys. Again, I will keep you up to date on what transpires in the Lori Vallow case that will be coming out later this week. Remember, the grand jury concludes on the 20th. You can find us at wesawthedevil.com. We saw the devil across all social media. If you like the show, love the show, want to financially back it, you can do so at patreon.com/wesawthedevil. And again, don't forget to subscribe and review. Until next crime.